It's always a privilege to welcome to this campus Mr. and Mrs. Brooks Hayes. They know that they have a hearty welcome at any time, and it is a delight for those of us who've been around here for some time to think back over the various times in the past when they have visited here, always receiving a hearty welcome and urgent invitation to return at every opportunity. Yesterday, Mr. Hayes spoke about a trip he made with his father when he was a boy, and I was immediately reminded of the time I first met Mr. Hayes. You may think I'm not all that old, but it was in 1928 when my father took me on such a trip. I remember it so clearly when he said, "We're going down to the courthouse." This was in Cleburne County, Arkansas. "We're going down to the courthouse because there's a fellow running for governor whom I want you to hear. His daddy and I used to play baseball together." So my father and I went down to hear a young fellow named Brooks Hayes speak that afternoon in the campaign for governor, which, as Mr. Hayes will tell you, has happened again. He lost, but he got my vote, and he's been getting my vote ever since. It is indeed a privilege and a pleasure to welcome him to this company, for he speaks not only with experience, but with genuine Christian devotion and commitment. And we heartily welcome him at this hour and shall hear him gladly.
Thank you, John. I was reminded by the references that my dear friend John Steele made to those days of campaigning in Arkansas of what a young faculty member at the Winston-Salem campus said. I was introduced to him, and he said, "You know, I'm from Arkansas, Mr. Hayes." And I said, "Do you remember the first time I ran for governor?" He said, "No, but my grandfather does." I'm accustomed to these references. I did age a bit with that comment. Another one in the same vein was what a man said about a letter from his son stationed at the Marine Corps in Quantico near Washington. Letter went like this: "Dear Dad, I was in Washington over the weekend, had such a good time. I saw Lincoln's monument, Lindbergh's airplane, the dinosaur bones, and Congressman Hayes." I think of John's father and Mrs. Steele's father. I knew both families, but thinking particularly of the ministry of his father, I think of him as a symbol for that vanishing group of devoted rural church leaders. And my father was just as fond of John's father as he was of Dad. My father was a great kidder. I told you yesterday something about his attitude over my possibilities as the President of the United States. But he was asked one time after the book that John and I co-authored, The Baptist Way of Life. It's out of print. I'd love to encourage some purchases for the royalty's sake, but it's out of print. This friend said, "Mr. Hayes, have you read Brooks's last book?" He said, "I hope so." I rather appreciated an introduction I got over in Kansas City one time. It was by a friend who had known me in Arkansas. I don't think what he said was true. I don't think it happened, just as he tried to make the audience believe. But who am I to complain about that? I have always followed Lewis Brownlow's theory: never dilute the oil of anecdote with the vinegar of fact. He said to this audience, "I was going through Russellville one time, and knowing that it was Brooks's boyhood home, I said to the old gentleman filling the gas tank, 'Is this where Brooks Hayes lived as a boy?' He said, 'Sure.' 'Did you know him?' 'Why, sure, everybody knowed the boy.' 'Well, what kind of boy was he?' 'Well, ordinary, normal boy.' I like that. Well, he said, 'Can't you tell me something special about him?' 'Well, I recollect that he loved that little Baptist church, that they just couldn't open the doors without him.' That, And of course, I was interested in that. He said he couldn't open the doors without him. He said, but it didn't prevent his being an ordinary, normal boy. Said, I seen him walking toward the depot one day, and I said, looked at him. There he was, had a valise in his hand and a Bible under the other arm. I said, Brooks, where are you going? He says, down to New Orleans to the Mardi Gras. I didn't like that because I knew how to pronounce him. Well, he said, what do you got your Bible under your arm there for? What are you taking your Bible for? Well, if the girls are as pretty as I hear they are, and if they have as good a time down there as I hear they do, I thought I'd stay over Sunday. I cannot plead for sympathy if I don't do well in these lectures, because I did have plenty of noise. Quite different from the time that I represented one of my favorite congressmen, Percy Priest from Nashville. I found a note on my desk one Saturday late afternoon, said, Brooks, I'm scheduled to speak at the Luther Rice Baptist Church tomorrow at 11. I've been called back to Nashville on an emergency. Please fill the engagement for me. That's all it had, just signed Percy. I did the best I could. Of course, I was going to attempt that service for him. And I went out as I was expected to represent him. And when I saw him later on Monday or Tuesday, he had returned from the emergency, and he said, Brooks, how did you do? Well, of course, the audience hadn't had any notice about it. I explained to him that there was real confusion about who it was in the pulpit. No time left to explain that it'd be Mr. Hayes instead of Mr. Priest. And Percy was eager to know how I did. Said, you get along all right? Well, I said, yes, I guess I did, Percy. At least one little woman came up to me at the end of the service, and she said, addressing me, Mr. Priest, I heard you on the radio 3 weeks ago, and now I have the great pleasure of hearing you in person. But I want to say I never heard a man improve so in such a short length of time in all my life. Well, he and I were members of a little Thursday breakfast prayer group, a little closed session there, and we got to be great friends. He was a great singer. I tried to be one time, and my wife says I sat singing back in the Russell Baptist Church by at least 20 years. But we were singing while we were waiting for a distinguished guest to join us, Sir Cedric Hardwick, the famous actor. And we were ahead of the other members of the little group, honoring him with a luncheon. And Percy struck up a tune, a very familiar tune, Amazing Grace, How Sweet the Sound. And we had a little duet there, and our backs were to the door, and all of a sudden I realized that our honored guest was standing behind us, Sir Cedric. And there was no interruption, we just went right on through the song. And when he could get to floor, Sir Cedric says, oh, I love those old westerns. One of my favorite Baptist friends was Harry S. Truman. In the Little Rock crisis once, I was talking to him over the phone. He said, Brooks, I have been thinking of you and feeling for you down there. And I said, well, thank you, Mr. President. You stood 8 years of it. I can stand 8 weeks. No, he said, it's harder on you than it was on me. I can cuss and you can't. Well, that has been quite a handicap in the profession of politics. Incidentally, Harry Truman had read the Bible through twice when he was 14 years of age. He was an omnivorous student and reader. And one day at breakfast time, a friend from the Methodist church had told me, said, you know, Mr. Truman, this was after he had finished his work at the White House, he was the ex-president at the time, said, Mr. Truman came out and made the banquet talk for my Sunday school class last night. I said, well, I'm eager to know what he chose as his theme. Well, he said he spoke on his two favorite chapters in the Bible. And I said, what were they? Well, the fifth chapter of Matthew, I said, Sermon on the Mount. And he said, the 20th chapter of Exodus. And I kept pondering that. I couldn't remember what the 20th chapter of Exodus was. And he helped me out a little. Well, he said, Brooks, I'm surprised that the president of the Southern Baptist Convention doesn't know where the Ten Commandments are located. And, of course, I could have said, well, I thought they were in the fifth chapter of Deuteronomy. But I didn't have anything to lean on. I was just embarrassed to death and embarrassed for my Baptist convention. I went over to my office and I had a phone call within 3 minutes after I sat down in the chair, and it was Congressman Burleson calling me. He said, "Brooks, I can't locate the Ten Commandments. Where are they?" I said, "The 20th chapter of Exodus." And he said, "I knew you'd know. I knew." Well, I must tell you another handicap I have when I don't have a manuscript, and I never use a manuscript, actually. I'm not a manuscript speaker, but I'm reminded when I have assignments like this of what happened to Jim Folsom, Kissing Jim, governor of Alabama, a very lovable person. And he, as all governors do, had to read a manuscript now and then. His experts would prepare special data that should be presented in a formal way. And just before he went out to address the Alabama State Teachers Convention, his aides handed him his speech. He hadn't had time to read it. So he just walked to the stand and started reading his speech. It went like this. Said, "My friends, I want to talk to you this morning about the discrimination against the rural schools. Our rural pupils suffer an extreme type of discrimination. In fact, Alabama is the lowest state in the Union in its provision, the per capita allocation for funds for the country schools. Even Mississippi excels us." And that was what he said, "even Mississippi." Well, I'll be damned, I didn't know that. That is all the cussing I'm going to do today. I believe in the cheerful banter between Baptists and non-Baptists, which is roughly the classification we make of the world's population, or between Baptists and Methodists, particularly because my wonderful mother-in-law was a Methodist, and we had a cheerful banter. I went down to speak at General Luska one time, and when I got back, it was, of course, the Methodist Assembly. She says, "Son, how did you do?" I said, "I must have done all right. They wanted me to come back and run for bishop." "Oh," she says, "go on. Methodists don't run for bishop." I said, "That's what you think." Then she knew how to take care of her end of it, however, because I was on the phone one day and accepting an invitation to speak at a Baptist meeting, and she heard me say, "Yes, I'll be there, and it'll be well attended. The Lord must have loved us Baptists. He made so many of us." And she muttered, "He was trying to get a good one." She lived long enough, and it was at the age of 95, to see me sworn in the White House as one of the special assistants to President Kennedy. And after a few remarks by him, I acknowledged it and thanked him and then said, "Mr. President, my mother-in-law is here. She's 95, and her presence is a tribute to you as well as to me." I said, "You're familiar with the old saying that back of every achievement is a proud wife and a surprised mother-in-law." And I said, "She is surprised. She believed I'd be the president." I believe, as I've indicated, in the cheerful banter between Republicans and Democrats. That sometimes puts a strain on me. But I stick to the principle of goodwill between the parties. I found an old clipping the other day. I'd made a speech in Columbus, Georgia in 1938. And the clipping set forth as the feature of my talk that I advocated a two-party system. I said, "We need to shake the grip of my party," and I was Democratic National Committeeman at the time. "We need a two-party system. We'll have better government if we can see developing in the South a strong Republican Party." Of course, I think they're overdoing it, but I believe in the two-party system. It's certainly better than the one-party system of Russia and the communist countries. I think it's better, and I presume we all do, than the multi-party system of Italy and France. I'm not sure it's better than the no-party system, which George Washington envisaged. But those are all theoretical speculations, and I want to move on to some other things. In that connection, however, I'm reminded of the farmer at Russellville. He came to town with his produce, including some chickens, dressed chickens. He'd sold nearly everything, but there was one lone chicken in the bottom of the barrel there, little ice on it. And before he left, Mrs. Wilson showed up about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. She said, "Have you got any chickens?" "Oh, yes," he said. She said, "Well, let me see one." So he goes into the barrel and appears to make a selection and brought that one chicken up and held it up for her. She says, "How much is it?" He said, "It's $1.14. She said, "Well, let me see another one." He goes into the barrel again and appears to make another selection, came up with that same chicken and held it at a little different angle. She said, "How much is that one?" He says, $1.19. She said, "I'll take them both." Yesterday, I attempted to speak of the introspection and the critical approach to church problems, the thing that challenges us Baptists to develop our greatest strength in moral leadership for a distraught world. Today I want to speak more specifically of the kind of world that we look upon through the windows of the church. Well, we'll see a lot of troubles in our world. There are some new crises that rather baffle us. We wonder how we can make our influence for righteousness and justice felt in the kind of world that is so divided. I want to say the hopeful things that I see in the world, and you know how I feel about the institutional life of our churches and of our schools. I believe in the American institutions of politics and of education and of religion, but I would never pretend that any of our institutions are perfect. We must have this critical judgment. I said yesterday the function of comforting our members is a supremely important function. But we cannot neglect the judgmental service of our church. And just as the prophet was able to stand boldly and say to David, "Thou art the man," God's prophets today must be prepared to say to political leaders when they're untrue to the basic principles of our faith, "Thou art the man." This is our rightful role. I do not ever want to encourage participation on a personal basis. I think that's for the individual minister to decide whether or not he wants to take a position. I believe he ought always to reverence the pulpit as neutral ground, never take advantage of the cloth, but I would never close the doors of opportunity to him to participate either as a citizen voter in supporting men that he thinks are worthy. I would never want that door closed to him. And some of our most effective members of Congress are ordained ministers. A church should always give a leave of absence if there appears to be something besides personal ambition on the part of the minister, because he has a contribution to make. And there are now perhaps 8 or 10 ordained ministers in the House of Representatives. One of my favorites is John Buchanan, a Republican from Birmingham, whose father I knew well when he was pastor of a church in Arkansas. John Buchanan is a good party man, but he is not doctrinaire in his approach. Now, I've never heard John speak as if he wore the mantle of authority. He told me once that when he was a student at the Southern Seminary in Louisville, he fell in love with a young lady, very attractive. She is very popular too. And he went to one of his professors, one of his favorites, and he says, "Professor Mitchell, I think it's the Lord's will that I marry Jeanette. It's God's will." Well, the teacher said, "Well, that may be, but you know, 6 other students have told me the same thing." And John said it apparently wasn't the Lord's will, because she did marry someone else. But sometimes advantage is taken of those who appear to speak ex cathedra when the quest for truth requires goodwill. And while there may be a strong conviction back of every utterance on the part of Christian people in the political forums, it must be done as Paul said we Christians should do, to speak the truth in love. And our government desperately needs this approach. So we must be calm and not panic, nor hate others who do not take the same position. My wife teaches a Sunday school class, or rather for 14 years she taught it regularly, the rather well-known Burrell class at Calvary Church, and I used to help her with her lessons and used to work hard at it. But one day she was trying to get hold of a thought, and she thought maybe I might have a quotation that would help her. And I'm strong on quotations. We folks who may be lacking in original thought do well if we reach over for the words of a powerful person. I don't like rice, but I love rice pudding if raisins are in it, and these quotations you hear me give are the raisins in a dull speech. And I gave her a good quotation. I said, well, what about Alfred North Whitehead's statement that civilization is an offensive against the repetitive mechanisms of the universe? She said, I wouldn't dare say anything that I don't understand. Well, I said, I'm never inhibited like that. But I said, we can translate it into the Vulgate. I said, just say, as my neighbor in Arkansas did when I was talking along this line, he said, that's right, Brooks, said everything that ain't nailed down doesn't come up. And I believe in translating it into the Vulgate. But she had a good memory. Incidentally, J.B. Grant, old Dr. Gambrill, one of the Baptist heroes of two generations ago, put it pretty well. He said, a man don't know nothing he didn't learn. And that can be put more grammatically, with more correctness, but there's a lot of truth in it. And so she said, yes, I remember, though, you quoted a Methodist preacher once who said, no man can live long enough to learn all he has to know just to survive. Some things he must inherit from the race. And both of these statements are true. I think you can harmonize them. There's an old Chinese proverb that a man who forgets his ancestors is like a brook without a source or a tree without roots. Of course, that was said much earlier when I guess it was Isaiah who told us to consider the pit from which we are digged and the stone from which we are hewed. It does not mean that we become idolatrous towards some ancient assumptions. Every postulate must be tested. And we make the mistake sometimes in our effort to respect authority and preserve traditions that appear to be wholesome for our people. We Baptists at times have made the mistake of making an unwise retreat, considering society's right to be dynamic and to have new ideas. We retreat to some old assumptions that are not sound. I stand on holy ground when I'm on this campus. I knew of the leadership that W.L. Poteet brought to the politics of the South, and it's a name to be revered. And I've often told others about the remarkable thing he did when he was bold enough to differ with many of our Baptist preachers who thought that the idea of evolution was anathema, that it was of the devil's work. And he didn't think so, neither did Dr. Mullins, the president of the Southern Baptist Convention. Dr. Mullins tried to do it in a winsome way, but it was obvious when you examined his language that he didn't think ministers or the Baptist people should ever require of a legislature that they say to the professors, you shall teach this or not teach this. And I think that's a sound postulate. And W.L. Poteet said that to his graduates. An amazing thing, there were 21 members of the legislature in this particular period, back in the early 20s, who had graduated at Wake Forest College, and they followed, except one or two, they followed the advice of their revered president. I often think of that as I pass that attractive building on the Wake Forest campus, W.L. Poteet Building. And of course, you're familiar with the achievements of that great man. There are other illustrations. I would be just as bold in defending the minister's right to say what he believes. Even his congregation has no right to tell him to preach anything. He's God's prophet in the pulpit. It doesn't mean he should be contentious or defiant. And in the Little Rock crisis, when I took an unpopular position, I hope I'm not speaking too often about it, but it contained so many things that are meaningful to me. I said to my son once, "Son, do I talk about Little Rock too often?" "Well," he said, "Dad, if you had gone to the South Pole with Admiral Byrd, you'd be talking about Antarctica now and then, wouldn't you?" And so I give it make these references only because of a point that I might make. One day, one of my constituents stopped me on the street. She says, "You make me tired." "Well," I said, "Ms. Brack, what have I done?" "Well," she says, "why don't you get off the fence?" Now, I said, "Aren't you scolding me not for being on the fence, but being on the other side of the fence from you?" She says, "Well, yes, I guess that's right, but you ought to shout out your position just like these other congressmen are, segregationists. You ought to tell them you're not a segregationist. You're for integration." "Well," I said, "I take this view of it, Ms. Brack. I want to be effective, and I shouldn't be scolded for trying to make appealing and attractive this position that I'm taking over the admission of the 9 black pupils to Central High School. I said, I shouldn't be scolded for that. I want to be appealing, and I'm not trying to ride a popular wave. I'm trying to make popular a position." And I said, William Howard Taft was asked one time, "Why are all fat men so pleasant and affable and agreeable?" He said, "We have to be. We can't run fast." So on the unpopular side, men should be forthright. And I think you can count on this spirit of tolerance and in the final analysis of devotion to our biblical faith. But we live in a divided world. First, we live in a divided nation, and I'm not thinking of political differences at this point. I'm thinking of the economic disparities. Wish there were time to talk about it, but I found again an old clipping the other day in which I had made some references to American sacrifice for the other world. It was during the Second World War. But I pointed out that with all that we were doing, all the sacrifices that we were making for our armed men abroad and the populations of our allies in that great struggle, I said, we're still giving only one cup of milk from a gallon, only one slice of bread out of the loaf, only 2 eggs out of a dozen, only 1 pound of meat out of 10 pounds of meat. And this is really not a test of our ability to sacrifice. And sometimes we have been critical of the government, defiant of the government, because we are unwilling to accept discomforts. I supported the Marshall Plan. I recall, though, that I was not making the best appeal on the Marshall Plan, because I used to go before chambers of commerce and the civic clubs to say, this is in our interest. Well, to be sure it was, and subsequent events proved that it was in our interest to pour $17 billion into the economic foundations of those countries that had suffered from the war. But I had a revelation from a simple talk in Adona, Arkansas. John and Miss Steele know where Adona is. And it was my practice to go to every post office once in a 2-year period if I could reach them. I got out of the car at Adona in front of the post office, and I suddenly heard a voice across the road or the street, and the inquiry was, "Is that Brooks?" Well, I left for him to call me Brooks. And I heard his companion say, "Yes, it is, Uncle Jimmy." "Well, lead me over there to him. I want to ask him something." And then I saw a white cane in his hand and saw them leading him, realized he was blind. He got up to me, says, "Brooks," said, "I've been hearing so much about this matter of sending help to those other people over there. Do you think that's all right? Do they need our help?" Well, I had just returned from a meeting of the Baptist World Alliance, and we were meeting in Copenhagen, in one of the nations that didn't suffer very much. The tables there were laden with good food. But I knew the conditions in the other parts of Europe because I'd visited Germany and France. I said, "Yes," I said, "it really is, Uncle Jamie. They do need our help." "Well, now," he said, "let me say this." He said, "My wife and I are the only ones in our family. We eat dinner." Well, I knew he meant the middle of the day meal. He said, "We eat dinner, and then we push it back and save what's left for our little supper. But if we're expected to sacrifice," he says, "I'm for it because it's our Christian duty." Now, if ever Baptists make the wrong decisions about matters that rest upon our duty to the disadvantaged peoples of the third world, we will be repudiating the most glorious triumphs of our history. I'm always glad to point out that in the pinches, in the great crises of ecclesiastical development, we have made the right decision. 150 years ago, when the struggle was between those who advocated no foreign mission program and those who did, we made the right decision. I was frightened that we wouldn't make the right decision over the Christian Life Commission. For every year we had to fight the opponents of this glorious adventure in the healing of wounds and the reconciling of race antagonisms. The very idea of one saying we shouldn't be busy reconciling the two races. But finally, the Baptists of the South made the right decision. So we must stick to this idea and have faith and hope that the Baptists will continue to exhibit the courage and the wisdom, the brotherly love that has to go into these supremely important political and economic decisions. There are 430 million people who will go to bed hungry tonight. The pangs of hunger will be there all through the day. But I noticed a survey that was made in Tucson, Arizona recently, and I fear it's typical of the larger cities, that they found in the place where unused food was dumped, not garbage, but loaves of bread, unopened roast, the meat that had never been cooked. They found enough to feed 3,000 people every week in the places that food was discarded. And we have been wasteful in food. Now, I'm not advocating that we do some dramatic thing like fasting one day. This has to be a corporate action. And America does not have, with all of its ingenuity and its productiveness, America does not have the resources to feed the world, to meet their needs. But we can be bold in leading the prosperous nations into a new attitude and through corporate action do the thing that has to be done. One thing that those who are doctrinaire in political matters, one thing they seem reluctant to recognize, and that is that many good things, Christian deeds, are not just the acts of compassion between neighbors and helpfulness of that kind, which in the days of the frontier, in the early life of America, was vital. We fail to realize that it needs a legislative and a corporate expression. I have a good text for this. It's in the 25th chapter of Matthew. And the strange words, when you come to think of it, I don't think I had ever read it with quite the depth of thought that I did recently. That marvelous statement about the Son of Man returning in His glory. Since it is language that seems so strange to the gentle rabbi from Nazareth, the carpenter, the friend of all men, with humility that no man has ever matched. It seems so strange to find in that story in Matthew that the Son of Glory shall return with all the holy angels with him to take the throne, or to take his position. He shall return to take the throne with all of his holy angels. And then there shall be gathered before him the nations of the earth. It wasn't a matter of just people coming. The nations of the earth will be judged. And you know the story. A marvelous and dramatic statement of what Jesus expected of his disciples. For when I was hungry, you gave me meat, and thirsty, you gave me drink, naked, and you clothed me, sick and in prison, and you ministered to me. And there have been many sermons preached on that, but I'm not sure I ever heard one who stressed the matter that the nation is expected to exhibit its nationhood, its sense of corporate action, to relieve people who are disadvantaged. This happened to be true in the race issue, which has tortured us in the South, certainly tortured men and women of a sensitive conscience, as I tried to say yesterday as a lad, finding a black man leaning against a rope, not permitted by the laws of my state to take a seat by me, though it was empty. He had paid as much for his fare on that train as my father had paid, more than my father paid for me, and as much as father had paid for himself. But my law, which was against the basic principles of my faith, said to the black man, you have to sit in another place, or stand, as he was forced to do. Now, I have said that in defense of the goodness of the South, and there are noble elements in our life, it's not going to force me into acquiescence to some of the claims that we cannot honestly make. But when I have quoted Robert E. Lee, one of the noblest men we ever produced, who said that at the end of the war, if readmitted to the sisterhood of the states, the South will do two things. We will be kind to the emancipated Negro, and we will obey the Constitution. Incidentally, the Little Rock crisis again tested me on this matter of constitutional law. I did not retreat from that. My legal training was not profound, but it was good enough to give me that concept of obeying the Constitution as Lee said we would. But on this matter of kindness to the minority group, I think by and large in the shops and in the kitchens and in the workrooms, we have been kind to the less fortunate black people, but this was not sufficient. The paternal kindness of the 19th century was not adequate for this dynamic 20th century. So I move into this area with complete assurance that I'm right about it, that there has to be a political and national expression of our love for less favored people. I am about to say, because I think it's true, that this nation cannot survive 80% affluent and 20% wretched. I've come home, you see, to point out that not all of the hunger is in foreign lands. It is here. And the challenge is to the Christian conscience to see that Congress reacts to the needs of our people. I am prepared in this matter of ideological conflict, the things that produce the conjure words, the words that conjure evil or good. Sometimes they become very bitter. I have had enough of the arrows aimed at my position to know how sometimes words can be very cruel and very misleading. We're in such a period now. To be a liberal is dangerous in some places in the South. But we ought not to let this happen. We ought to rise above it and seek the truth, and not be captives of a label. One man stopped me again on the streets in Little Rock once. He says, Brooks, I'm against communists, I'm against socialists, and I'm against sociologists. And we who are amateur sociologists are sometimes victims of that. My little wife knew my position when I was summoned to Rutgers University to be their visiting professor of politics. And the newsmen were there. They were curious about me. And one newsman said, "Mr. Hayes, I see in this university blurb," that's what he called it, and I guess it was, "about you that you're a lawyer and a politician and an author and a churchman, and now you're going to be a professor. If we asked the real Brooks Hayes to stand up, who would stand?" And I was ready to say, in all honesty, "the politician." But before I could say it, my wife confused them further by speaking up, just an Arkansas social worker. And this has been one of the glorious avocations of my life. And social work is God's work. We must find better ways of doing it. And not all of it can be done by the churches. Our resources are not sufficient. Even Aristotle, who was not one of the disciples and who was not privileged to know our Lord, said that politics is the chief of the sciences because it alone has the power to allocate the always scarce resources of any society to the various elements in that society. So it doesn't make sense for us to permit in our country such disparities of income. Those at the very bottom, the lowest 10% of our people, have only 1% of the gross national product of this nation. The next 10%, so we consider the lowest 20%, have only the 4% of that total. And the upper 20% has 44% of the income. Now, when you consider ways of rearranging things, that money might be more equally distributed. And I'm not advocating that, because this is not egalitarianism. This is Christianity. So we've got the problem, you see, of finding a just economy, a just society. And sometimes this does call for sacrifice. So I'm willing to go in any direction, take any position, whatever they call it. They won't call it communism or egalitarianism. But I know if I go the direction in which the New Testament asks me to go, and the insights that can come out of the meditative and prayerful life, I know I'll be in line with Christianity. And I'm prepared for whatever sacrifices there are in adhering to the Christian doctrines of justice in the economic order. And we'll be much happier. Just as the South has slept better at night, having finally acquiesced in the demands of the national conscience for equality between the races, the South will sleep better at night when we do something about the poor among us. I rode 100 miles in the South the other day from one city to another. I don't want to be more specific than that, but I rode 100 miles through the countryside. And except in the towns through which we passed, I didn't see a house that could meet the requirements of habitable homes for our people. And when I find 20% of the construction workers, industry, out of work today and idle, and drawing upon the largest of our unemployment funds through the enlightened funds that we have, the legislation that makes it possible for an unemployed man to receive a weekly check, and he should. But when we find 20% of the men in the construction industry unemployed, there ought to be ingenuity enough to thrust the power of our nation and our economy into the problems of the rural South. Now, our lives are interrelated and interlocked. Naturally, being from the rural South, and the first time I ever saw my name mentioned in a book, I rejoiced in it because it was a beautiful summary of my position in the South, although the author had been a bit critical of something I had done. But he said, "Nevertheless, Mr. Hayes has never ceased to love the rural South that nurtured him, the nurturing South." I loved what Francis Sayer said in introducing me in Philadelphia recently, the grandson of Woodrow Wilson. He said, "Mr. Hayes comes from the Ozark country, whose people he loves. And he learned from them that the profoundest ideas are the least pretentious and are best conveyed by the little chariots of anecdote and gentle humor." This was not only a compliment, but it was a reminder that my humor, if I resort to it, must be gentle. never carrying a barb. So I love the rural people of the South, and I love the city people of the South. But like Henry Clay, I am not of the South or North, the East or West. The nation is my home. And I hope my beloved Southland, there's still a great tenderness here. I hope my Southland will be more flexible in its political thinking and will try above everything else to attend to the needs of the disadvantaged peoples of the world and of our nation. My time is almost up. I am reminded of the two farmers that walked away from a speech I made in Salgahatchie, Arkansas. One of them said, "Well, old Brooks could have done worse." And the other one said, "Yeah, if he'd have had more time." I had some other pretty good points here. I'm going to have to forget them and use them. Ask me back sometime, John, and I'll keep these notes and tell you what you didn't get. My mother used to say when she made donuts and I'd left to watch her, she'd take the little things, you know, that she'd cut out to get the hole in the donut, and she'd pull it all together and then make another donut or do something with it. She said, "Let nothing be wasted." And these notes are too good to be wasted. And I'm going to talk a little more about the affluence, because that little church at Russellville I loved very much, talked about it a great deal. It was a good symbol of democracy, but it's quite different now. I think maybe I haven't told you about Miss Helen, who did my mother's washing. She sat on the same pew with us. Mother called her Miss Helen, and I like to think of her, this poor person, her sitting there by father and mother on that third pew. She couldn't give as much to the church as Dad, nor could she preside over the Missionary Society with the dignity that my mother had. But in the votes that were taken in that congregation, Miss Helen's vote was equal to my father's. And it's a beautiful symbol to me. But there's also a reminder of our imperfections, because I must, in the present perspective, remind myself that if Miss Helen's skin had been black, she would not have been there. The little black world of our community was another world. But to our credit, it isn't that way now. There's a boldness and an independence and a love for others that reshapes our patterns of life. Well, I think John referred to my two defeats for governor, but that was a long time ago. Or maybe you didn't mention the second defeat. You just talked about the first one. But I want to be entirely honest about it. I wasn't defeated for governor twice. I was defeated three times. I went back to make a campaign in 1966. And I won't say ever that it was a mistake for me to run, though I did not seize the prize. But I went back to run for governor because I thought it would be a symbol if the moderates could win. And the fact that we didn't quite make it doesn't hurt me particularly, but I have learned how to accept defeats. And let me make this point then with what was said after that third defeat in 1966. For the students of political science, I rather think it's a footnote to history. I believe I may be the only man in the political history of the United States that waited 36 years before running again. Nobody can say I acted rashly. But again, I was defeated. Conceded defeat at midnight, went home, got 8 hours of sleep. And if the newsmen asked me if there were any painful moments in it, I could say no, except just one brief painful moment when my wife brought my favorite cereal. And I said, "I can't eat it." And she said, "Why?" I said, "It's the breakfast of champions." And she said, "She says you eat it. I think I know you well enough, and we're developed an intimate enough friendship here for me to tell you a little family secret. What she said was, "You eat it. Around here, you're still the champ." Well, we've tried to make a team of it. But when I went down to headquarters the next morning, my manager, who was a woman, and I'm a great believer in the liberation, though we haven't needed it in Arkansas, but I hope to live long enough to walk into the White House someday and say, "Good morning, Madam President." When I got there, this brilliant political person said, "Miss Hayes, we're taking it in stride. You told us to. No weeping." But she says, "The young people are not happy. They're disconsolate. Could you say anything to cheer them up? Some of them are weeping." I said, "Let me meet with them at 2:00. I'll come back. And just nobody but us, just me and my young people." And I did, and we closed the door. And I said, "I know why you are unhappy. You wanted me. I was your favorite. You wanted me to be the governor. You wanted to see me ride in that big black car. You wanted to hear the band play in my honor. You wanted to come to the governor's mansion to a reception to hear me called governor. These things will never be. I will never be the governor. But these things are baubles. The important thing is you find the inner satisfaction of doing what you believe to be right, to promote the causes that you know are in harmony with the basic assumptions of the thoughtful Christian person." I may have used the Judeo-Christian because in politics it must be an all-inclusive kind of philosophy. But I said, "You must tap the sources of your religious faith and find a way to live out your calling and your opportunities, whether you ever hold office or not." And I wound up with this thought to them as I wind up my last appearance with you. I said, "God has let me stand in a high place and look over into the promised land. I'm sure I will never occupy it, never possess it. I probably will never penetrate it. But because I know something of your devotion and have seen young high school and college students give their time to a cause they believed in, black and white young people, boys and girls, I have a great satisfaction in the confidence that in some way you will not only penetrate, but you will possess the promised land. This faith and hope still in my own heart persists. Thank you."
Brooks, we will indeed invite you back. But underlying special invitations is an always standing invitation to you and to Mrs. Hayes, a warm welcome at all times. Will you pray with me? Eternal God, we thank Thee for the beauty and the joys and the gifts of this Thy day. Especially do we thank Thee for the ministry of Thy servant who has brought us this word from Thee. Let the favor of Thy presence and the joy of serving Thee continue to bless him. Bless us as we go forth from this place. Let light attend our ways, and let us wear Thy name with grace to Thy glory and to the blessing of Thy children, through Jesus Christ our Lord.